Welcome to Brains Matter, the podcast on science, curiosities, and general knowledge. I'm your host, Just an Ordinary Guy. So, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Brains Matter. Today, once again, I've got Dr. Ross Church, who is a postdoctoral researcher at Monash University. He's previously talked to us about hypervelocity stars, so that was a very fascinating interview, so I encourage you to go back and listen to that. And today, we're going to talk to Ross about binary stars. So, Ross, can you tell us, just as a simple introduction, what is a binary star?
A binary star is a pair of stars which orbit one another around their common centre of mass. Most of the stars in the universe are in a binary or some what's called a higher order collection of stars, a set of three or more.
So
stars.
You can have three or four orbiting around the centre of mass.
Yeah.
Okay, because that was one of the questions that I had from a listener a while ago about whether they had to be in pairs or whether they could be higher orders as well.
So a pair is stable for a pair of stars at almost any separation, as long as they're not too close that they interact with one another. We can come on later to some of the ways in which they can interact with one another. And as long as they're not too far apart, that the binary can get disrupted by other objects or events in the vicinity, then a pair is stable. But if you have three stars, it's only stable if one of them is on a much wider orbit than the other two. So you have...
So you couldn't really have a triangular configuration then?
No. And what you have... You have to have what's called a hierarchical system. That is that you have different things on different scales. So you can have two stars close together and one further apart. Or you can have two pairs of stars close together orbiting one another on a much larger orbit. And those two things are stable. But if you have three stars all orbiting on similar scale orbits, that's not stable.
So that will break apart fairly soon then?
Yeah.
Can you have a configuration like a solar system, for example, so a primary larger star in the middle and then other stars orbiting around?
As long as the central star is really a lot massive, more massive rather. So the solar system works because the planets are all rather low mass compared to the star.
So the reason I'm asking this question is because of the conjecture that I've read in the past about Jupiter is not quite big enough to be a brown dwarf, and we've talked about hot Jupiter type planets around other stars. So if you have other stars which are large enough to be, say, brown dwarfs or something similar, could they be in a solar system type orbit?
It's relatively unlikely. I mean, we have found planets around stars other than our own, and we have sometimes found planets of almost brown dwarf masses. I mean, most of the planets we've found are of almost brown dwarf masses. They're a few times the mass of Jupiter, but a lot closer to the Sun than Jupiter is. And there are some systems we've found where there are a couple of planets of that sort of mass. But once you get to a mass that's high enough that you actually see a star, that you get nuclear burning in the core of the object, you tend to need this hierarchical separation, as it's called. A solar system only is really stable if the planets don't interact too vigorously.
So this covers the comment you made before about orbiting around a centre of mass between the objects, because I guess if you have a solar system type configuration, the centre of mass is the large object in between rather than the centre of mass between the objects.
Well, yes, I mean, the centre of mass between the objects is the thing you need, but for the solar system, that's always well inside the Sun. So you can just treat the Sun as being
that centre of mass.
The centre of mass, exactly, yeah.
You mentioned a little bit earlier that most stars in the galaxy are in binary format. What is that percentage, do we think?
So this is a very active area of research, and very interestingly, it seems to depend very much on what the mass of the star is.
Mm-hmm.
So very massive stars, ones sort of between 5 to 10, 20, 30 times the mass of the Sun, they're basically all in binaries. Mm. Whenever you look at them, you tend to find them in the galaxy in small clusters of maybe 30 or so stars, and you find that they're almost all in binaries. If you look at the low-mass stars, the ones between, say, a tenth and a half of the mass of the Sun, because a tenth of the mass of the Sun is about the lowest mass star that burns hydrogen, you find that there's a lower fraction of them in binaries, that there it's relatively rare to find a binary. But for stars similar to the Sun, a bit less or a bit more massive, about two-thirds of them are in binaries.
Okay, now for the tough question. Why is this so? Why do stars prefer to form in binaries as opposed to our Sun, which is by itself?
And yeah, it's a very interesting question, and it's one we basically don't have an answer to. It must be something in the details of the star formation process. So stars form from cool molecular clouds, effectively clouds of small molecules floating through the galaxies. If one bit of them becomes a bit more dense than the rest, then you get effectively a runaway process whereby the extra overdensity, as it's called, the more dense lump in the cloud, attracts more material in towards itself because of its gravitational pull, and hence becomes more dense still. So that collapses down to form a protostar.
Mm-hmm.
And what you tend to have is this protostar, you get an accretion disk around it, as it's called. And that's the material falling into it tends to form into a disk, a plate-like object, which is spinning round the central protostar, and material accretes in through a disk like this. And there must be some process which causes these accreting protostars to fragment so that you end up with a pair of objects, both accreting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not yet at all clear what that is.
Okay, because
we do see, and sorry to interrupt you, we do see in the numerical simulations, you can do large numerical simulations of this process. They're very difficult, they're very time-consuming, and a lot of the physics which is probably relevant, we know, isn't yet included. But you do sometimes see these forming stars fragmenting into binaries.
I guess for me that was always the question, because I can understand how stars form and, say, a solar system forms around the galaxy, that accretion, this concept, mentally makes sense. So trying to understand how that splits is something that I struggle with when I think about it.
Yeah. And it kind of makes sense that you could have two overdense lumps in the same cluster at some point, and then each one would continue to attract material inwards. Whether that's exactly how it happens, though, I don't know.
Do we know how many of them actually form as a binary and how many are actually captured into binaries?
That's better known. And they must, by and large, most of them form, almost all, in fact, form as a binary system.
Okay.
Because it's very hard for one star to capture another.
Mm-hmm.
Because
of the vast distances.
Because of the vast distances, but also, if you have two stars coming together, they've come just under the influence of their own gravity.
Mm-hmm.
They've come together from far apart. But because the total energy, the kinetic and gravitational energy, is conserved, that means they have enough energy to separate themselves out again.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want one star to capture another, you have somehow to dissipate some of that energy.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that if they get very close through through tides, analogous to the tides on the Earth, which are formed by the sun pulling the water in the seas up and down as the Earth rotates round. One star can deform effectively another star if they get close enough. It pulls some of the material towards it, and you make the star slightly elliptical instead of spherical. Mm-hmm. And that's a process where you can convert some of the orbital energy into heat, and hence you can dissipate that energy and you can capture a star into a binary. Mm-hmm. But that only really happens if the stars get very close indeed, which is rather unlikely because of the, as you say, the great distances between them, the mm-hmm. sparseness of space.
When we look out into the night sky with optical or radio telescopes, and we know there's an object out there which looks like a star, for example, Sirius for thousands of years was thought to be a single star, but we know it to be a binary today. How do we know that an object we're looking at is a binary as opposed to a single star?
Yeah, so there are several different ways which depend on how close the binary is to us and how it's arranged on the sky.
It's now time for Listener of the Episode. Today's Listener of the Episode is Beth Roy Samsel from Knoxville in the US. Thanks for joining the Facebook fan page, Beth. Now, back to finding out how we know observationally if a star is a binary or not.
One thing is that many binaries eclipse. In the same way that one can get eclipses because the moon passes in front of the face of the sun, mm-hmm. the solar system, if you've got a binary star, usually both of the stars are in view, but you can't tell them apart because mm-hmm. the separation of the binary orbit is much smaller than the distance from us. So they appear as just one star. But if one of them comes in front of the other one, it blocks the light from that star. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at the star, what you see is just a dip in the brightness.
And there's a bit of a flicker.
Yeah, and a slight change in the colour as well if the two stars are different colours. Mm-hmm. And so you can look for this process because it happens with a regular period. And the first eclipsing star like this for which the period was measured was Algol back in the 18th century.
And that's the star, not the computer language.
That's the star, not the computer language, exactly, yes. And from that, you can measure things about the orbit of the two stars. Mm-hmm. So another good method is what's called the radial velocity method. And there, you look at the star and you measure its speed, the speed with which it's moving away from or towards you using the Doppler shift. The Doppler shift being that if the star's moving towards you, it looks a little bit more blue. The line emission and absorption lines in its spectrum become slightly bluer. And if it's moving away, it looks slightly redder. So if you have a binary in which one of the stars is much brighter than the other, so you can only see one of them, then you see the emission lines in that spectrum moving backwards and forwards from being slightly redder to slightly bluer. And from that pattern, you can tell whether the orbit's circular or whether it's elliptical, and you can measure its period. And you can get a handle, though not an exact measurement, on the mass of the star as well. And sometimes you can see both stars, and then you see the two lines moving exactly out of phase with one another. That is, as one gets redder, the other one gets bluer, mm-hmm. And vice versa.
Okay. A little bit earlier, you mentioned the various types of interactions between binaries. Did you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So one thing I mentioned earlier was the tidal interaction mm-hmm. that dissipates energy, but it also aligns the spins of the star, the rate with which they spin, to have the same period as the orbit. A tidal interaction like that is where we always see one face of the moon, because the period of its spin is the same as the period of its orbit, so it always points the same direction towards us. Also, if one of the stars becomes a giant, which it will eventually, it grows
Is that because it pulls the gas off the companion star?
No, just from its own internal evolution. Mm-hmm. Eventually it will run out of hydrogen at the core.
Okay.
And when that happens, you get a shell of hydrogen burning moving out through the star.
And a dense core.
And a dense core, mm-hmm. exactly. And this causes the outer layers to swell up mm-hmm. and the star to become much larger. And when that happens, some of...
Can I just interrupt you there? Mm-hmm. If a lot of these binary systems or binary stars formed at the same time, would that mean that a lot of them would evolve at the same rate? Or why would some evolve at different rates if they formed together?
Yeah. So if the two stars in the binary, they will form at basically the same time, but if they're slightly different masses, then they'll have different lifetimes. Mm-hmm. Or indeed, if they're very different masses. So more massive stars, although there's more material there to burn, it burns more quickly, so they actually live for a shorter length of time.
Mm-hmm.
So what usually happens is that the more massive of the two stars will run out of hydrogen at its centre first, and then you get this process of it forming a giant. And as the outer layers swell up, they become closer to the other star,
mm-hmm.
To the point where you can get material transferring, as in it's torn off the outer parts of this swollen star, and it's accreted onto its companion, mm-hmm. so you get matter flowing between the two.
So do they accrete towards the companion because it's more dense than the huge bulge on the giant? Because I guess the question I'm asking is the giant going to have more of a gravitational pull because of its sheer size versus its companion, which is smaller, but the companion is more dense, so which will accrete the matter?
Yeah, so the giant, being the more massive star, has the stronger gravitational pull, but it can become large enough that its outer layers are sufficiently close to the other star that they feel its gravitational pull more strongly.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that the Sun has a much greater gravitational pull than the Earth, but stood on the Earth, we're so much closer, we only really feel the effects of the Earth's gravity.
Okay.
And so it's because this star becomes so huge that it's reaching out close to its companion, that its companion can suck the matter off its outer surface, effectively.
So does that mean that the companion star then grows and becomes a lot bigger?
Yeah, the companion star certainly will become more massive, and this transfer of material can become unstable, and then we get effectively a big cloud of material surrounding both stars,
mm-hmm.
a huge puffed up object. And what happens there is that the accreting star and the core of the giant spiral together, and what was the envelope, the outer parts of the giant, is thrown off, and it forms what's called a planetary nebula, mm-hmm. which is nothing to do with planets, it's just the name they're given, but you get this cloud of gas that's thrown off the two stars as they spiral together, cools, and as it cools, it becomes very colourful.
Mm-hmm. Like wonderful NASA images.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
And an interesting question, can binary systems have planets?
The answer to that is yes, but it's much more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way that systems of three or more stars have to be hierarchical to be stable,
mm-hmm.
the planetary system has to be also, in a sense, hierarchical. So if you have a wide binary, the two stars are a long way apart, you can fit planets round one of the two stars, and as mm-hmm. long as the planets are sufficiently closer to their star than the companion star, mm-hmm. then that system is stable.
The reason I ask that is because to date we've found in excess of 250 extra solar planets, and the feeling is that there are a lot more out there than we know about. And given your earlier statement that most of the stars in the solar system are binaries, I'm just wondering how many of the binaries would have planets as opposed to singular stars. And that being the case, talking about the interactions you were mentioning before, what effect would those interactions have? Because if one of the stars got a bit closer, wouldn't it just destroy the planetary system.
Yeah, the usual effect is that the orbits of the planets become unstable and they get kicked out of the of the system altogether.
So if we were looking at, you know, the Star Wars movie from 1977 where he looks out into the sky in Tatooine and sees three suns, that's not really possible.
It's relatively unlikely. You could have, say, a triple system, as it's called, with the two stars relatively close.
Mm-hmm.
The two stars very close, and then a planet orbiting them, and then a third star orbiting the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could have a planet attached to the third star in a triple system, so mm-hmm. that it can see the star it's orbiting, and then the binary star, which all at a great distance off. But it's relatively unlikely.
Okay. Well, on that bombshell, I'd like to thank you for your time once again, Dr. Church.
Thank you very much.
It was a fascinating discussion, and I wish you the best for the future. I also hope you enjoyed hearing the native Australian bird wildlife in the background during that interview. And now for some listener feedback. There are a few responses to the episode about science songs. Fabry from the UK wrote in and said, "Fantastic show, really enjoyed it. Will there be a sequel? Hope so. Cheers, Fab." Well, Fabry, perhaps at some point in the future. We didn't get through even a quarter of the suggested songs, but there are plenty of other topics for me to go through in the meantime. David J. Bernstein from the US wrote in and said, "I listened to the show today. Great. Every now and again, it's good to have a fun episode." It certainly is, David. Mark and I both had fun doing it, and I hope yourself and other listeners had the same experience while listening. Michael David Smith wrote in and said, "Enjoying the podcast, but still very, very, very far behind." That's okay, Michael. As long as you're finding it enjoyable and learning something new, listen at your own pace and keep the feedback coming in. Well, that's it for today's show. I'll leave you with a quote from Stephen Covey. "The way we see the problem is the problem." Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Brains Matter website at www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. And you can find all the other episodes of the show there. Just click on the podcast link on the right-hand side. You can listen to the episodes from your browser by choosing Flash Player from the links and selecting whichever episode you want to hear from within the player. There's also other information on the site, such as links to articles and news, subscription details, both via iTunes and manually, and voting information. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can leave an entry on this episode's show notes on the webpage, or you can send me an email. All my contact information can be found on the site. The theme music Future is performed by Cut Copy and comes courtesy of Glenn Gertz from Modular Records. I hope you enjoyed the show. Bye for now.